You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggle for love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, Sarah Van Gelder, founder and editor-at-large for Yes Magazine, joins us on the show to speak about the inspiring stories of change she found on her 12,000-mile odyssey across the United States, searching for and writing about the revolution where you live.
As editor of Yes Magazine, I've always had the question, you know, what can we do and where are the best possibilities for moving forward? And I decided if I really wanted to know the answer to that question, it was time to take a deeper dive into what was happening at the grassroots in the United States. And especially, it was time to go to places that I don't normally get to.
When God stood before you with her hand,
hello and welcome to all of our listeners near and far. This is your host, Rivera Sun, and I'm on my own this week. It has been a wild couple of weeks in the social political arena. We've all been following Standing Rock very closely. We've reported on it on the show before. We also have been covering news of the way people are organizing to counter hate and discrimination wherever it might rear its ugly head in our communities. And I hope you all enjoyed our last interview with Tom Llewellyn of Shareable.net. It has been a really interesting couple of weeks. So I want to welcome to our show today, without further ado, Sarah Van Gelder. She's the co-founder and the editor-at-large of Yes Magazine. And if you don't know this journal, I personally really enjoy it. I get great ideas for it. I've even implemented them, some of them, in my communities. I believe, actually, my sisters have even been in Yes Magazine. I think I caught a column about them and the work they do with food distribution for local farms in Maine. Totally surprised me because they didn't even tip their hat that they were going to be featured in one of my favorite journals. But we're going to talk with Sarah not just about Yes, but mostly about her new book, which is called The Revolution Where You Live. And I'll let her tell you the story about this 12,000-mile odyssey. Welcome to the show, Sarah, and maybe we can jump in by letting our listeners know, what inspired you to go on a 12,000-mile road trip around the U.S., finding some of the most inspiring revolutionary stories you could?
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. So about this time, well, a little bit longer than a year ago, after nearly 20 years editing Yes Magazine, I was looking around and sort of doing a little assessment to see, you know, just how are we doing on the things that Yes Magazine really cares about. We have a situation where, you know, people now for decades have understood that climate change was a real issue, and yet the climate crisis is even more present than ever. We have a growing inequality in spite of some really important social movements. We still have growing numbers of people who are insecure. Something like half couldn't scrape together $400 if they had an emergency. We have all the political pain that goes with that incredible level of exclusion from the economic largesse of our society. So all these things were continuing to go on. And as editor of Yes Magazine, I've always had the question, you know, what can we do and where are the best possibilities for moving forward? And I decided if I really wanted to know the answer to that question, it was time to take a deeper dive into what was happening at the grassroots in the United States. And especially it was time to go to places that I don't normally get to. You know, I spend a lot of time at conferences and meeting with people at the, and especially, you know, I have to admit, I especially spend time on the two coasts, the East Coast and the West Coast. So I decided I wanted to be able to have access to other parts of the country. I was going to need to drive, not fly, not just take trains as much as I love trains, but to drive from place to place. And that way I could spend time in the really remote communities or in the inner city and neighborhoods that don't normally get covered in Appalachia. And so that's what I did. I got myself a little Toyota pickup truck. I bought a little tiny camper that could sit in the back in the bed of the pickup truck. And I took off in August of last year and spent four months on the road.
So one of the things I read in your book about your camper is that you named it Caracol, and there's a whole story behind why you chose that name. Do you want to share that with the listeners and maybe then dive into where you went first on your trip?
Sure. So I named it Caracol because that means snail shell in Spanish. And I figured, well, I'm going to be carrying my home on my back just like a snail does. And I also realized since I bought a small little pickup truck, a four-cylinder pickup truck, I realized this was going to be slow. I wasn't going to be hitting the top speeds. And I was going to be taking my time when I went to different communities. I didn't want to be a helicopter in, helicopter out journalist. I wanted to spend time with people. So it was going to be slow journalism, just like there's slow food that takes a while to grow and to cook, but is worth it. I felt like this was going to be slow journalism. And there's one other thing about that name, which I really love, which is that in the Spanish word caracol is one that's used by the Zapatistas to represent their communities of good governance. So the communities they've created that have autonomy, and they're able to run themselves and have that sense of values, the indigenous values and the values of taking care of one another baked in. So I like that that idea too. It resonated with me as I started my trip. So where I went first was to I started here in Seattle, and went first to learn about a big coal mine that was planned for Montana. And part of the reason I was tuned into that is because here in the Northwest, there's been an effort to build a great big, I think the largest coal terminal, coal export terminal in the country, just north of Seattle, to ship coal from the Powder River Basin of Montana and Wyoming to markets in Asia. And the native people here, especially the Lummi tribe, have been very strongly opposing this coal terminal for all sorts of reasons, including the impacts on their traditional lands and the pollution of the Puget Sound and the number of tankers that would be coming in and out. And so they've been putting up a tremendous struggle to stop this coal terminal. And what I wanted to know is, well, where is that coal coming from? Because, you know, I sort of thought coal was on its way out. And so I did a little research and found out that it would be coming from this proposed new strip mine in southeast Montana, which the Northern Cheyenne tribe really doesn't want, and the local ranchers really don't want. So I decided to go find out what was happening there, and it turned out that there was going to be a ceremony right around then where the Lummi tribe from north of Seattle were bringing a totem pole that they had carved and bringing it out to the Northern Cheyenne tribe as a gift, as a way of saying, you know, we're in this together. For the Northern Cheyenne tribe, it would be a giant coal mine. Right in their midst, they'd be turning this beautiful, pristine Otter Creek Valley into this giant hole in the ground to extract coal. So they'd have all the impacts of basically industrializing a absolutely beautiful part of the country and the traditional lands. It's not right on the reservation, but it's very close to the reservation. For the ranchers, it's like a major attack on their way of life. It would cut some of the railroad spur that they would need to build in order to access the mine, would cut right through a bunch of their ranches, and the railroad would go right along the side of a lovely river out there. And the ranchers are just adamant that you know, part of their responsibility, just like it's part of the native people's sense of responsibility, is to take care of the land and pass it along to future generations in good condition. So on both sides of this railroad, on this coal train, you know, from source to export, it would create terrible damage. And along the way, it would be spewing coal dust out of these open coal cars. And then, of course, when it gets to Asia, it's not like it's going to be a big boon to them either, because people in China are dying in the thousands from the effects of all that coal burning, all that pollution. So it's basically a bad idea from start to finish. But a couple of coal companies and a railroad company thought that they could make a lot of money from doing it. So I traveled out to this remote part of Southeast Montana just to see for myself what that was like and who the people were that were opposing it and how this group of ranchers and native people were getting along in their efforts to stop this coal mine.
One of the things that I've been surprised to see over and over again is these unlikely allies cropping up. It's like this substrata, like this mycelium level beneath the surface of our nation are these unlikely alliances, whereas our animosity as a populace or subsets of the populace tends to spring to the top of the news where we have differences of divisions, where we're caught in hatred of one another. But beneath the surface, there are these rather remarkable unlikely alliances that are forming as business as usual starts to violate more and more of our commonly held values. And I'm wondering if you saw signs of this in other places in the country as well, as you were traveling around.
Well, certainly. And, you know, in this case in Montana, that is exactly one of the things I was so struck by. I heard the ranchers saying things like what I heard the native people saying in terms of this land is land that we inherited and we have the responsibility to pass it along to future generations. The land is sacred. The water is sacred. And I thought, wow, there's something about both of these groups who have such different histories, but have this deep attachment to place that transcends the normal differences that, as you say, we hear about in the news so often. So some of them, you know, there were ranchers there who declared themselves to be Republicans. It wasn't that they were all, you know, environmental activists by any means, but there was something about that relationship to place and the long-term relationship they had to one another that somehow was more important than the animosity or than the any political divides or differences in background. Somehow that sense of love for place was able to transcend that. And I found that just fascinating. They both were able to transcend those differences, but also that there was something very powerful about what happened when they did. Because when they showed up together at the Montana legislature, and, you know, they could have a powerful voice that neither group would have been able to have on their own. And when they showed up together along with the environmental activists and the scientists, and they could have just a tremendous impact. And in fact, one of the amazing things that is true of that story is that mine is not going to be built. It's not going to be dug. It didn't happen until after I got back that I learned the news that the coal company finally decided that project was not going to happen. And one of the reasons they decided that was because of what they called regulatory uncertainty, which is another name for we give in to the protesters, you know. They're not going to give up. We're going to give up because this is going to take us forever. So even though nobody ever quite said these ranchers and these native people beat us, that was actually the case.
I want to go back to this idea of place because it seems in your book that it recurs as a theme again and again and again that maybe a sense of place is becoming the saving grace of the United States, that we went through a massive wave of quite intentional homogenifying. I'm not sure what the exact word is for that, but where we just saw a corporate wipeout of all of our downtowns and our main streets and the cultural diversities that existed from state to state, where Walmarts took over mom and pop stores and big name brands took over the downtowns or drew usually the shoppers and the tourists and the community out of the downtowns. But in your book, one of the things that I noticed in so many stories, whether we're talking about Cincinnati or Newark, New Jersey or Detroit, Michigan, was this recurring deep sense of place and a kind of almost orneriness in people to not give in to the structural displacement that is built into our current economic system, along with gentrification, the rises and falls of the housing market, the ways that Detroit was a really good, really amazing, powerful story of this, the way that the bottom fell out of the auto industry and the jobs got shipped overseas and the town collapsed, but many of the people endured and committed to rebuilding Detroit. But at the same time that they were building, there's also a whole other kind of rebuilding going on in the downtown, which is very privileged, which is very destructive in the long term to the sense of place and uniqueness that many people are trying to maintain, preserve, and even build for the first time in some places. So would you speak a little bit more about what you saw around this theme in various places throughout the U.S.? Because I found it really fascinating to hear those stories and that theme so strong within them.
Yeah, you know, I was sort of surprised by that, too, because I intentionally went to some places that I didn't think I was especially going to like. You know, I went to Newark, New Jersey, which honestly has been a city that I've flown into when I want to go to New York. But my first goal is to get out of Newark to where I really want to be. And this time I went to Newark and spent about a week there. And one of the things I realized is that people in Newark, New Jersey love their place too. In fact, I saw a mural. This is part of the new mayor's efforts to revitalize the community. They're commissioning artists to do murals on city walls. And this mural, one of the phrases sort of hidden in the mural was, "We the people love this place." And then another place nearby on the mural, it said, "In fact, we the people call this place our home." And it really took me aback because I realized that even the places that I hadn't thought of as lovable, that it's when it's your neighborhood, when it's where you grew up, when you're familiar with the local parks, when you have neighbors you love and care about, when you have the memories that are intertwined, the memories of growing up or of your children intertwined with places, you form that kind of a bond. And that bond is very powerful because I think it does help to build a tenaciousness to then protect that place and to rebuild it, even in the face of some really difficult odds, which are very much present, especially for impoverished communities around the country. So yeah, I think in fact that we evolved to appreciate and understand and deeply know a place. And I think our modern society has been trying to tell us that that doesn't matter, that you can pick up and leave and move someplace else. And that old pioneer idea that, you know, if one place doesn't work out, just move to the next. Or if you ruin one place through mining or pollution of various kinds, just pick up and move to the next place. And I think that we're kind of switching to a new ethos now as people realize there aren't any more sort of new places, that there aren't throwaway places, that we kind of have to make it work where we are. And if we do that, if we allow ourselves to deeply immerse ourselves and to love a place and to love a community, to love the other people in that community, even if they're ornery and difficult and there's all the issues that go with conflicts among people, even so, that provides a foundation for life that is so soul satisfying and is what we evolved to do. And I think actually is really the only way that we can have a really healthy and sustainable society. Because part of that attachment to place is also understanding the particular ecosystem of that place and what it means for not only we humans to thrive, but the other living organisms in that place, to really wrap your mind around that question at the same time as you're wrapping your mind around the health of your own family and community. And that all works together when you spend the time to become deeply immersed and deeply connected to a place.
Now, your book covers all kinds of really interesting stories, and sometimes in just one short section, you cover many interesting stories that are going on in one area. But I'm curious, did you know that you were going to find and research these stories before you got to a town, or did you stumble onto them? Did you get referred to other stories along the way? How did you find these amazing stories?
Well, all of the above. I sort of had an idea that I was going to make a big circle, starting in Seattle, going east across Montana, North Dakota, into the Midwest. I knew I wanted to spend time in the Rust Belt cities because I feel like there's so much suffering there and so much potential for change. And I wanted to get to the South and the East, and I wanted to understand better how people are taking on questions of racism and racial exclusion. And I knew that I wanted to get to the Southwest. So I sort of knew that I was going to make some kind of a big loop. And then I knew a few places that I wanted to visit because I just had curiosity about them. Or I'd spent some time in Detroit, and every time I go back, I just am so inspired by the stories that I learn from people that I know there. So I knew a few places I wanted to go. And then I also put up on social media, if I was on my way from North Dakota heading east, you know, I put up on social media, okay, this is the direction I'm going. I'm going to be in Wisconsin. And I'd get these responses like, oh, we're doing this really interesting thing in our community. You should come visit. And if I could, and if it made sense in terms of the route, I often did drop by and met people that I'd never known before and learned all sorts of interesting things from doing that. So it was a combination. I really wanted to stay open to what I could learn that I didn't already know about, and at the same time, build on some of the friendships and connections that I already had established.
What were some of the most inspiring stories that you found, or the most unexpected stories that you found?
Well, I could tell you one from Appalachia. So I visited a place called Whitesburg, Kentucky, which is right in the middle of what they call the coal fields, the area of Kentucky that has relied on coal mining for generations and, of course, is now suffering from, suffered from the coal mining itself, all the health issues that came with that, but now is also suffering from poverty and unemployment. So I went to visit that community because there's a organization there called Apple Shop, which has been working on restoring and renovating the Appalachian culture and encouraging people to play music and to make quilts and to do some of the other things that are really integral, endemic to that particular part of the country. So here's one of the things I was surprised at when I visited there. They have a radio station of their own, and of course they play traditional music, but they also play hip-hop. And it turns out that within the listening distance of that radio station is something like 7 penitentiaries and jails. Kentucky has been using the mass incarceration as a way to provide some kind of an economic substitute for coal mining. So they've been encouraging prisons to locate in Kentucky. And so there's a lot of people from Midwestern cities who've been transported to these remote communities, to these prisons. And so there's a pretty big listenership for the radio station for the hip hop show on Monday nights called Hip Hop from the Hilltop. And one day somebody called in from one of those cities and said, you know, would you pass along this message to my relative who's in one of these prisons? So they did that, and they realized there was this tremendous need for people to connect back with their family, and they started a whole other part of the radio show where they take calls for several hours every Monday afternoon, and people record them on their voicemail, and then they edit them all together and just run them back to back. All these call-outs from people in Chicago or Detroit or Cincinnati calling in to their loved ones in these prisons and just saying, you know, I love you, or saying, you know, here's your sister just had a baby, or saying, you know, here's what's going on in my life, or just keep your head up. And they just ran all of these together. So every Monday night for an hour, you can hear these messages that go out to these prisoners. It's very moving, just hearing that sense of connection and that sense of longing and the sense of the love that people have for people behind bars and how much they're missed. And the woman who started that program, I asked her about that, and she said, well, you know, some of my white neighbors, they don't know why we're doing that. And I thought, but she knows what she's doing. She knows that part of what she's doing, in addition to providing a service to those people behind bars, part of what she's doing is also humanizing those people who are part of that Whitesburg community, even though they're not allowed out from behind those walls. She's sort of introducing them to their neighbors so that the predominantly white people in that community realize that these are human beings that they're sharing this land with. So that was a story that surprised me. And the turns out the head of that organization, Appleshop, as of about a year ago, is an African-American young man who grew up in Appalachia and also in some of the nearby cities. And I interviewed him and I asked him, what is it like to be African-American in the midst of this region that's known as a bastion of racism? And he said, well, it's awful. He said, every interaction I have to think about how much race is going to be driving what happens and who I can smile at and who I can't smile at. And then he said, but, you know, I don't think it's right that people in this region are ridiculed. I don't think it's right that Appalachians are treated as though it's okay to laugh at them for not having indoor plumbing or not having good teeth. We don't treat people that way. We don't allow people to treat African-Americans that way, and we shouldn't be treating these folks that way either. And I was so impressed by this man who both was experiencing all the challenges of being racially excluded and at the same time standing up for the rights of other people not to be excluded and not to be ridiculed. And it made me think a lot. I've been thinking a lot about this since the election of Donald Trump, because, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how much working class white people have felt left out and excluded and ridiculed. And I really got to thinking a lot about the question of dignity, because there is no shortage of dignity. There doesn't need to be groups of people excluded from a dignified life. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to say we all are entitled to live in a dignified way.
I think it's a very powerful story that you just shared, and one that touches upon something that I experienced growing up around the urban-rural divide. I grew up in Maine, which is a very rural state. And as a teenager, everything that was cool, everything you wanted to be, the only place to be, really, if you were going to make something of your life, was the cities. And we have exactly 1.5 cities in Maine. And so I was part of a generation that was called and dubbed the Maine brain drain, because so many of us left the state seeking jobs in cities and where the action was happening. And yet now, 20 years later, there has been a reverse trend, a whole renaissance of people moving to Maine, not just Mainers, so some of them are staying, but people from out of state, a lot of young people who want to be doing farming, who want to be closer to the land, who want to be part of artistic communities. And it's totally head spinning for me to go back and visit my family there now, because it is shifting so rapidly. And I think this respect for place is actually very much at the core of it, that the influx of new people who just wanted to like perch on a little plot of Maine land and farm some vegetables and go to farmers markets on Saturdays, they had to run up against Mainers, white Mainers, who have been there for a long time. They had to learn and meet and know that there is an indigenous community there. We also had a large influx of immigrants from all places in the world. When I was growing up, there were 1,000 Somali refugees that came to our tiny little town that was maybe 6,000 people large. And those were the first black people that many of us had ever seen. And inside all of those shifts and changes is the need for deep listening, for respect, for dignity, as you said, and also for learning how we grow together. Where do these behaviors and patterns that are not our highest humanity, where do they come from and why? How do they spring up and why do people cling to them? Like, why are people racist? Why do they cling to that? What's underneath that that's so important to them? What are they afraid of losing? And so when you mentioned that you chose to get out of the coast and go to what is often termed the big red swath of the middle of America, or the big red and purple swath, I was very heartened by that, because I think there's so many stories there that need to be told. And in telling those stories, it helps to give everyone a foundation of their own internal dignity and respect. which then creates our capacity to look at each other with dignity and respect as well. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly Nonviolence Minute. Nonviolence Minute comes from Michigan Meta Peace Teams. With concerns about hate crimes, harassment, and intimidation on the rise, many people have been asking for resources about what to do if you see harassment or intimidation occurring in front of you. These suggestions from Michigan Meta Peace Team are used during their trainings for street actions and are handed out when they are maintaining peace and de-escalating violence in their streets, communities, and neighborhoods. So here are five things that you can do if you witness harassment or intimidation. Move close to the person being harassed. Introduce yourself and begin a discussion. This will create a zone of safety. Continue the conversation until the harasser leaves. Stay with your new friend or offer to provide accompaniment to the point that the person feels safe. The second thing you can do is to rally others in the vicinity to form a protective circle around the person being harassed, or encourage others in the area to join you in loudly shouting, "Stop it now." A third thing you could do is to interrupt the behavior by asking the aggressor a question to throw him or her off balance, such as, "Excuse me, can you tell me how to get to?" Or, "Hey, didn't we go to the same high school together?" Try to redirect the person's energy by creatively engaging the person. Don't debate. Look around for common ground or an entry point into a conversation that takes the focus off the person being harassed. The point is to stop the person's behavior, not to win a political argument. Number 4, if you cannot directly intervene, document what you are witnessing. Observe details. Use your phone to take pictures or videotape. Discern whether or not it is a good strategy to let it be known that you are documenting. Sometimes this works as a deterrent, other times it may escalate the situation. The fifth thing you can do is to not take away people's agency to defend themselves. Sometimes the best approach is to remain physically close, using body language to convey solidarity and support, especially if the person being harassed is verbally engaged with the harasser. Jumping into action too quickly can have the effect of disempowering others and actually escalating the situation. These are 5 tips and tools that Michigan Meta Peace Teams uses both here domestically in the United States and abroad internationally in their work in violent conflict zones. They go by invitation to help communities start to form their own teams that have skills for interrupting hatred, discrimination, intimidation, harassment, and violence, and to de-escalate situations from the point of violent conflict into a place where the situation can be resolved by nonviolent means. You can find out more about them at www.metapeaceteam.org. Hearing these 5 tips and tactics for dealing with these very real problems that we are now confronting in our streets and in our communities is just one reason why we really feel that it is important to spend these few minutes each week on the air with you, sharing the tools of active nonviolence. Whether it's you being harassed or someone whom you're trying to help, you might find that knowing your nonviolence will change your life. And now let's return to speaking with Sarah Van Gelder. And so my question is, really, were there places that you wanted to go that you didn't get to?
Oh, sure. I mean, I only had 4.5 months, so there were definitely places I had to skip over. So one of them is I went to Greensboro, North Carolina, but I would have loved to spend more time in the Deep South. And partly just for that reason you're describing, because it's an area that frankly frightens me for all of its history of divisiveness and violence And I felt like I was able to get into some of that in North Carolina in Greensboro. Part of what I was there for was to learn about the massacre that happened in the late 70s, where some Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis killed six or seven, I can't remember the exact number, but six or seven people were out demonstrating for workers' rights. And this community has been trying to cope with what that means ever since. So I went there partly to understand how they were doing that and how they were using truth and reconciliation to try to understand that and to come to terms with it, and where they were going with the whole question of the deep racial divide and deep legacy of violence. But I would have loved to have spent some time in some other communities learning about their particular way of doing that. In the South, I did look into that question of race in a number of different places as I went. You know, this was the time that the Black Lives Matter movement was particularly strong, and I think a lot of people had kind of come around to the point that they see that racism isn't going to go away without some really serious work. It's not just going to be, you know, an African American president or a new policy. And it's not even going to be just some people who have best friends who are of another race. It's going to take some really deep dives into our own history and coming to terms with the extraordinary damage that has been done and the extraordinary trauma that some segments of our population have had to cope with for generations. And so I just wanted to understand how that works on a local level. And I came away believing that race, too, is an issue that we have the best chance of transforming community by community, that we have to build the relationships and build the new kinds of understandings about what happened in our particular community and what we're willing to do about it and what we're willing to do to commit to one another, that we will not allow that to happen anymore, and what we're willing to do to actually change the power relationships in our community. And I just think that has to happen one community at a time. It takes a deep kind of work, and a work that I feel like our society is ready to embark on now. And I think it has to be done at the community scale.
Now, another big, broad, sweeping issue that you were concerned about when you set off and embarked on this journey was climate and environmental destruction. Along the way, what did you see that reassured you or gave you hope? And what did you see that was very concerning or alarming?
One of the things that I was most encouraged by was what I mentioned earlier about the way the Otter Creek mine was stopped. Another story along those lines, I went to the Fort Berthold Reservation, which is three affiliated tribes. It's been overrun by the extraction of oil from the Bakken oil fields. Lots of fracking, lots of pollution, lots of radioactive pollution. The government of North Dakota has sort of allowed tremendous exceptions to their pollution standards so that the dumps are allowed to include more radioactive materials and stuff that's being thrown in the water. So it's an environmental problem, but it's also been a real social problem for that tribe, because some people are leasing out their land, or they're making a lot of money from fracking, and including some members of the tribal council, and other people are poorer than ever. And meanwhile, there's all these new jobs, so new people coming into town and into what they call man camps, which are very intensively newly built temporary housing for employees. And there's often a lot of crime associated with that, and prostitution and human trafficking and drugs. And so it's been a real mess that is created in that community. And so I visited there and talked to some of the people there. And then I visited another reservation a few hours north in North Dakota called the Turtle Mountain Reservation, the Turtle Mountain Chippewa, where the Turtle Mountain Chippewa live. And learned that in that reservation, they had an elder from that tribe had called together the women and said, you know, it's the women's responsibility in our tradition to take care of the water. And what do we think about this fracking thing that seems to be heading in our direction? And so the women got together and studied it and looked at what had happened in Fort Berthold and said, you know what, we do not want that here. And they brought it to the tribal council, and the tribal council took it to the whole community, opened it up for discussion, and decided unanimously that they were going to ban fracking from their reservation. And that's what they've done. When I was there, I had an opportunity to talk to the tribal chairman. And, you know, and I asked him, how did he feel about leaving all those millions of dollars on the table that they could have had if they'd allowed fracking to come in? And he said, you know, I've been looking at what's happening there at Fort Berthold. And, you know, they say money doesn't buy happiness, and you can sure see that. And I don't have any regrets at all. I'm used to making money the old-fashioned ways, which is you work for it and you have a business, and that's fine with me. We don't need that other stuff. So it was so interesting to me to see what happens when people have that level of sovereignty over their land so that they can make that kind of a choice. Because there's people all over the country who are trying to stop fracking from coming into their communities, but they keep getting overridden by big corporations who buy off big government, and they end up being forced to accept pipelines and accept fracking wells that they don't want. And it was so interesting to see what happened in this community where they had the sovereignty to decide and the astuteness to look into it and really research what the implications were, and the astuteness to realize that their water, their beautiful lakes and groundwater that's so abundant and so beautiful in that part of North Dakota, that was far more important to them than any money that they might make through some kind of temporary fracking boom.
I think that question of sovereignty, and maybe another word that people might relate to that, is actual functional democracy, not the charade of democracy that we tend to live believing in, but actual functional participatory direct democracy is a theme. Like, we don't know really what we would do as a populace, all 320 million of us. We have all these conjectures about what is an American, what do we believe in, what do we promote, what do we support. But many of those conceptions are actually coming out of quite a manipulated and, I guess, enfranchised for the very few system, which disenfranchises the very many. And so one of the things that came up that you just mentioned with the tribe was this concept of enough, having enough, that we don't need these huge greed-based types of industries. And that was a theme that you also wrote about with the New Era Windows Company and the decisions of this once private company that has a long story that I hope you'll tell some of, to change to a worker cooperative, and how the workers actually are finding a resilient niche within a very challenging economic field of industry because of their willingness to work together to have enough together and not major profits or big salaries for the CEO. Would you speak about the New Era Windows Company and perhaps this broader theme of having enough?
So the story is that they were employees in a window and door factory, and some years ago the owner decided to shut the plant, and I think they were moving the factory overseas. And so that's not an unusual story, but this particular owner didn't pay them the wages due and severance pay. So they occupied their factory until they got paid. And eventually there was a compromise reached. The union came in and helped out, but there was a compromise reached. They ended up selling to another company. The company kept the jobs and people kept working. But they were kind of alerted to this possibility that this might happen again and began looking into other options. And sure enough, it did happen again. This new owner decided to close the company. And this time they said, you know what, we would like to own the company ourselves. And they occupied again, and they got help from their union and lots of activists again. And they eventually were able to buy out the owner so that they could then own the factory. So now you have all these workers in control who've been line workers. They're not necessarily the people who've gone to, MBA school. So they have to learn business. But they also realize that there's a lot they already know because they've been doing the work all of this time. And when they share their knowledge with one another, they actually know quite a bit. So they have that going for them. They have going for them a funder by the name of Working World, which labels themselves patient financing. So instead of saying, we have to maximize our returns to our investor, they accept money from investors who are willing to accept enough return, not huge return. And because of that, they can wait until the company is able to make enough profit to be able to pay back their investors. So that gives them some leeway. And another thing they said gives them some leeway is that they're not having to raise enough money to pay a huge high CEO salary. And all the benefits that go with that. So they run the business themselves and they pay themselves, but they don't have to come up with an exorbitant amount to pay a CEO. And likewise, they don't have to come up with returns to some big Wall Street investor that wants to be making, you know, turning around their money really fast. So that whole notion of enough, I think there's one other aspect of enough, which was that they looked at what kind of equipment they really needed and what kind of facility they really needed, and they trimmed things that really weren't necessary or parts of the business that weren't necessary so they could focus on the parts that they thought would have the most effectiveness. So in various different ways, they said, you know, we don't have to – a big company might say, you know, we could make more profits by outsourcing, but we don't have that in mind as our primary goal. Our goal is to do good work and to make enough money to live off of, but we don't have to compete with the lowest paid workers around the world. We can just do what we can do and make enough money. And so far that's worked.
I think that's such an inspiring story. And one of the things that our listeners know is that a couple months ago, we had Chuck Collins and Daryl Garner, both former members of the 1%, on the show to talk about giving it all back and living on just enough. And then their efforts together with other people in a project called Live, Share, Grow, a movement for the 100%, to actually challenge the entire 1% and the 99% to move towards this philosophy of having enough, of sharing what we have, of finding a way that we can actually support and nourish all the people in the world, not just some of the people in the world, and then challenging our own internal programming around this hyper-consumption that is what the American dream. Because many of us, in fact, one study from the UN, I believe, says that 46% of the American populace lives at or below international standards of poverty. And the key thing in their statistic is that we just can't afford the cost of living right where we are. So these ideas and these strategies are ways that we can do acts of intervention, small and large scale, to start to transform this inequality, which was also on your checklist, Sarah, of issues that you were concerned about as you embarked out into the world on this tour. Because inequality is such a huge driver of injustice in this country. People don't really realize it, but we're a very wealthy country. We're one of the wealthiest countries in the whole world. But one of the things that I found is really important, sitting down with people from all different backgrounds, is to find ways to invite them into the change. And that's one of the things I like about your book, Sarah, is that you're really taking an approach of, here's a great idea, wouldn't you like to know about it? And guess what? This is also something that you can perhaps adapt for your own community. And at the back of the book, there is a list of 101 ways to reclaim local power. Where did that list come from, and what are some of the things on that list?
Well, the list just came from sitting down with a pen and brainstorming for a while. And also, you know, besides editing Yes for 20 years, where I've been looking for those stories and reporting on those stories and researching those stories. So part of it is from that. But the other part is that I've done a bunch of work in my own community and learned as I did that work about how local power can be built. And actually, that's something I'm really interested in pursuing. I'm really thinking about the possibilities of beginning a school for people to learn from one another how to build local power. So I just think there's so much that we can do. And I just to go back to your point about overconsumption and inequality, I think a lot of the consumption is actually out of fear, right? That we're afraid that if we don't hold up appearances and don't drive a good car and don't keep up, that we're going to slip off the edge and into real dire poverty and homelessness. So I think there's a huge amount of fear in the way that our economy is structured. And when I go to places like in Latin America where people may be far poorer, but don't feel that they're at the edge of falling off that kind of cliff, I'm just always struck by how much happier and more relaxed people can be in that situation. So I don't think it's just that Americans have this voracious appetite, although I think the advertising industry has certainly provoked that. I think there's a fear of not having enough and falling off that edge, and there's a fear of not being respected, and there's a sense that somehow the stuff is what's going to protect us from all the things that we're afraid of. So yeah, there's 101 of these, so I won't read many of them, but there's everything from, you know, running for school board or local offices, not just thinking at once, you know, every 4 years, well, can we get a super progressive president, but what can we do to lay the foundations for a really progressive community right where we are? Or convening a book club and using the book club as a way to discuss big ideas so that you know, you and some other people can sort of deepen your own understanding and your own sense of purpose and common shared understanding about what's possible. And another one, I mean, they range from things that you can do just in a moment to things that would take years to do in this list. One is to meet for coffee with somebody who's feeling isolated. And, you know, I've thought a lot about how much in our society, how many people can get isolated, from the elderly to new mothers with their children trying to stay home or trying to cope with work and raising tiny babies. There's so many ways that people in our society get isolated, and that can be so debilitating. So just small ways of reaching out can be enough to make a real difference. Another is clean and conserve water by creating wetlands and rain gardens. So just, you know, in your own yard or in a park nearby, you can use different kinds of gardening techniques to clean the rainwater before it goes into the nearest body of water. So there's lots and lots of different ways, and some of them, as I said, are major efforts, and others are just that sort of sense of reaching out to the people immediately around you or to the natural world that's immediately around you.
Well, I think we had a story on the show a few months ago of a woman who was speaking about a wild backyards project that she started in the original suburb of Chicago, which is now actually very much part of the city of Chicago. And she was saying, we just started planting native plants. And then we started watching the birds and the butterflies and the insects and the aviary species come back. And now what scientists have demonstrated is that our tiny backyard by tiny backyard effort connected two wildlife refuges on either side of the suburb. And that in turn connected the entire Great Lakes region all the way up to Canada and all the way down to Mexico in rebuilding a vitally important corridor for wildlife. And in some ways, on the human level, on the political level, on the social level, that's what I feel about this list of 101 ways and these stories that you're bringing forward to people right now, Sarah, and the work that Yes Magazine does as well, is that piece by piece, we're starting to illuminate this whole other world that wants so desperately to come into being. It's not just that the situation we're facing is so dire, which is also very true. It's that the beauty of what's coming is so profound. It's pushing at the seams of reality, just waiting for us to put our fingers into that point of change and tear it open a little bit so that the light can come shining forth. So I want to thank you for helping that illumination reach more people. And I want to just remind anyone who tuned in halfway that we are speaking with Sarah Van Gelder. She is the co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine. And I imagine you had to become the editor-at-large to travel on this 12,000-mile journey across the United States to collect the stories that became the basis of your new book, The Revolution Where You Live. Sarah, where can people find the book? And then what are some last thoughts that you want them to go away considering?
So thank you for asking. The best place to go is revolutionwhereyoulive.org. That's just no HTTP or any of that, just revolutionwhereyoulive.org. The site also includes blogs I wrote from the road. So there's some of the stories that didn't make it into the book are here on this site, revolutionwhereyoulive.org. And as far as final thoughts, you know, I've been mulling a lot, as we all have, the implications of the last election, and thinking a lot about why some folks are feeling so excluded that they would choose to vote for somebody who then seems to want to turn around and exclude other people. And I keep coming back to that notion that there is enough dignity to go around, that everyone deserves a chance at a good life. Everybody deserves a chance to be included. But I also have been thinking a lot about what role does community have during a period of time that's really, I think, is quite dangerous. It's really quite troubling in terms of what a Trump administration will bring. And I'd like to suggest that there are three R's, if you will, three R's that communities offer. One is resistance, because I think we're going to have to resist some of the worst of the Trump initiatives, especially those that vilify certain people in our community, people of color, disabled people, immigrants, Muslims. These are the groups that Trump seems to believe he can somehow affect his agenda by vilifying certain segments of our community. So one thing we can do in our communities is resist that, is we can reach out to one another, make sure that we can do all we can to make sure everybody's safe, that we have built the community infrastructure to know how to respond in the case of hate crimes or threats against any segment of our population. A second R is renewal, because I think even as we're perhaps seeing a hiatus in any progress at the national level, we can still move things forward in our communities. And in fact, that's where forward momentum is still possible. So we can be working on climate change in our communities. We can be working on developing more equitable structures. We can be working on connecting to one another and creating a stronger sense of community. And then a third is resilience, because I think when we're there for one another, we can accomplish all sorts of things, and we can have the kind of ways of life that really nourish us and really allow us to raise our children in a good way and to create the kind of possibilities for future generations that I think we all want to create. So I would just encourage folks to not think of this as a time of despair, but to think of this as a time to go deep in your communities with the other people where you live, and to take the time to build that community infrastructure, to build those connections, to build the capacities, the ways of working together that will benefit you no matter what you all decide to do, that will just make it possible for you to create the kind of life that you want.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for spending so much of your life helping us connect to these stories and digging them out and researching them and writing about them and bring them to our ears and to our hearts and to our minds and into our local communities through the actions that thousands and millions of people are choosing to do all over the country. Thank you for playing such a vital catalyst role in that.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I encourage you to check out revolutionwhereyoulive.org and also yesmagazine.org.
Thanks this week to our guest, Sarah Van Gelder. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson in Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. We're always happy to hear about new stations picking up our show, so if you do talk to your station manager about it, be sure to send us an email and let us know. You can connect with us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes. I'm your host, Rivera Sun. Our guest this week, Sarah Van Gelder, has traveled the U.S. searching for stories about how ordinary, extraordinary people are making change. So, listeners, maybe you'll find one more way to be a part of the revolution where you live by the time we talk to you next week.